Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Hey, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking time. A quick introduction for people who are listening in. So my name is Linda, and I have Lisa with me. She's the correspondent of Wall Street Journal, where we first met. She spent more than 15 years covering Asia, with a strong focus on China and Southeast Asia. She's also co-authored a book, Surveillance State, in 2022. Currently, she's taking a sabbatical and pursuing a fellowship. So I'll let her tell you more about it later. But today, I'm excited because we're flipping roles. I will be interviewing her instead of her interviewing my newsmaker. So thank you for your time. So maybe for a start, something lighter that I asked all my guests. Since you woke up this morning, did you manage to take a pause?
So we're recording this at 9 a.m. So since I woke up this morning, no, it's been back to back because I'm getting my second one ready for school. My husband really helps out with my first, but it's a very rainy day, so it's been hard to take a pause. Yeah.
Thank you for making time. I hope this is the pause that you've been waiting for. So maybe just to give more context, I guess, for people who are listening, to me, this is a very special episode because I wanted to spotlight like a key journalist that I personally liked, you, because I believe that every story that a journalist wrote gives us the opportunity to kind of pause and reflect on the state of world and our industry. I want to kind of throw the question back to Lisa and just to find out like what makes a great story and I guess why are you keen on tech in China?
Yeah, so I am a reporter for the Wall Street Journal and I've covered China tech for 9 years. So that's my background and I guess that's why you asked about tech. I would say what makes a great story, journalism really is more art than science. You can't, for example, you talk to someone and they tell you five things, but there's only one thing that sticks in your head and you know exactly that that is the story. That comes from a couple of different things and a lot of it has to be played out over time. I mean, firstly, I think we should talk about a mission. Journalism is always driven by a mission. And for us, you know, every profession is driven by a mission, but for journalists in particular, it's about telling the story when nobody else tells it. And often these are stories or these are areas that you find that policymakers have overlooked and you want to tell the story, hoping to prompt some action that it will be fixed. So, you know, that really is kind of the mission of journalism, so to speak. You uncover these areas, marginalized communities, and you want their voice to be heard, right? Telling the story when no one else tells that story. So that kind of helps you hone down on what sort of story you write already. And then knowing what's a good story, what distinguishes a good story from a great story is mastery of your beat. And mastery of your beat, you know, it's not something that happens overnight. It's really understanding the people in the space, the developments in the space, understanding it enough to know that, and also understanding your reader, understanding it enough to know that, okay, when you hear something, that is the story. So it's not a prescriptive method to understanding what a great story is. It's really like it's more a feel. So heads more art than science.
Why are you keen on, I guess, tech in China?
Yeah, I can tell you why I'm keen on tech alone, and then we can talk about China. But technology is amazing because, you know, I'm the type of person that, well, everybody looks for change in their job every 2 or 3 years, right? You get that kind of itch where you want to change what you're doing. And in the last 9 years, I've been able to change whatever I've been writing about, my topic of focus, many, many times, and still be able to stay within the realm of technology. So I'm still writing about technology, but within technology, there's hardware, there's software, there's mobile internet, there's AI. I mean, I started out writing about Alibaba, which was at that point, you know, 9 years ago, China's largest internet company. Alibaba is no longer an internet company. It's no longer an e-commerce company. It's an AI company. So technology evolves at the same speed that I felt my interests can be kept. Mm-hmm. So it's been hard to move from technology because, it's impacting every sector of life, right? It's upended the way we shop. It's upended the way we drive. It's upended the way we do things. 10 years ago, or, you know, in 2010, before the advent of the iPhone proper, like, nobody would have imagined life with an iPhone. Now nobody can imagine life without an iPhone. And China is just one of those places where it's so dynamic when it comes to innovation. There are a lot of ways to look at China tech innovation, but the tech innovation that I was exposed to was super dynamic. It was constantly iteration. You know, they barely finish version 1.0 and they're already starting on 2.0. So it's just very dynamic.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that kept you going for 9 years. Is that something that you will continue to pursue after this fellowship, or you might be doing something else?
A lot of things are up in the air. It's hard to tell. I mean, I love China, but with the fellowship, I'm learning about biology. I'm learning about nuclear energy, nuclear fission, fusion. So there's a lot, you know, climate change. There's a lot more to be writing about, but I still love technology. So it will be related to technology. As to which part of the world, I'm not entirely sure.
That's great. We don't want to lose you because we want to keep reading your stories. those years that you've been covering, I guess, tech, were there moments that made you pause while you were pursuing these stories?
Yeah, so the moments that made me pause were really journalism related. What makes you pause is fact-checking. I think there are two things that went in a good story. It can be great content, but what makes a great story as well is that it's accurate and it's not biased. So I think the pauses really come when you have to pause to ask yourself, is this story balanced? Are the words, you know, are the descriptors that I'm using, are those balanced? Because with great journalism, I feel like you want to lay out the facts for your readers and then you have them make the conclusion. You don't want to tell them what to think so much. Each story will have some sort of slant and you can tell which side the writer is leaning on. But the best stories really kind of lay out the facts and then have the reader make up his mind on what exactly he wants to feel and what's the takeaway from the story. So I think a lot of time has to go into like making sure that your writing is balanced. And a lot of time has got to go into fact-checking. So this newsmaker is telling me this. He says it's the best thing in the world. Is it really truly the best thing in the world? And this is the part of journalism that people don't see, right? Then you have to ask a lot of people what they think to make sure that this guy really deserves to be saying it's the best thing in the world. And I think covering China adds a layer of complexity because the Chinese government doesn't value engaging with foreign media and foreign press. So you could come to them with a request for comment. So in journalism, what we do is when you write a story, for everybody, every entity, character that you mention in the story, you have to seek comment. And very often when you seek comment from the Chinese government, it's a blank slate. They don't respond. It's like talking to, you know, a black hole. That also means if it's an inaccurate story, you're not going to be corrected. The onus is on the journalist, I feel, to make sure that what you're writing is accurate, because they're not going to correct any inaccuracies. And fake news travels a lot faster than truth.
Wow, that makes the job really hard.
But essential.
And, yeah, totally. And again, you know, you've done a multitude of things. Tell me more about the book that you wrote 3 years ago, Civilian State. Obviously, it's about China, as we were just talking about it. Kind of what inspired this book and what did you hope to, I guess, achieve alongside your co-author, I know, Josh Chin, right? Yeah.
So what inspired the book was really a series of stories that Josh and my colleagues did, looking at how China was embracing technology to control its population. So surveillance has always been a key aspect of authoritarian regimes, particularly in one like China. But surveillance has always been very human and non-tech. It's always been very dumb in that way. So you know, you have in the past what you call dang'an in China, where throughout your life, you know, people are taking notes about you, and it goes into this dossier, so to speak, that you live with your whole life. And these are like human notes and human reflections. How did you do well? How did you do in high school? How did you do in your first Communist Party job? How did you do in this factory? And we thought it was interesting that China was really kind of upending this system and kind of improving it by using technology. And they would use technology in ways that were very either pioneering or unorthodox. Pioneering in the sense that you've seen now, it's commonplace to see surveillance cameras all around. And these surveillance cameras are equipped with AI, either facial recognition or some sort of image recognition to tell you if an intruder had passed through this gate, right? Or if someone, you know, someone whose face is in the system had passed through the gate. People use AI to get into their office buildings now. You know, 8 years ago when we stumbled on the topic, it wasn't commonplace. And China really was the place that pioneered a lot of these innovation. But they were also using it in not just like positive ways, but some ways that were, I felt, quite disturbing. So they would be using, they would install facial recognition cameras in subways to watch out for people of interest. And people of interest in China can range from, it's literally people of interest to the Public Security Bureau, which is the Chinese police. And you can range from a wanted criminal to just someone who had ended up, you know, protesting at like a Taiwan's independent protest. So you could, you know, you can see the range, really. It's quite large and not, you know, they have different definitions for what a person of interest is. So they were using that in subways in 2016 to catch people who were on the loose or people who were known drug offenders, for example. And in some cases, and I think this is quite controversial, but they were also looking out for people with like history of mental illnesses, people who in some parts of the world you would not discriminate against, but in China would be seen as person of interest. So they were using it in darker, more nefarious ways. And I think the other way that our book brought out and we tried to humanize was the data profiling that they did in the western parts of China, where ethnic minorities like the Uyghurs, and the Uyghurs really share, they don't look Han Chinese at all. They are Chinese, but they share more characteristics with like the people from Turkey and, you know, either religious habits, the way they look, the way they eat. But they're an ethnic minority in a country that's largely Han. And what the Chinese government did was they used data. They took notes. They made these Uyghurs fill out what we call a population form. They call the population form, and you would have to tick, you know, how many times you went to the mosque each week to pray. Well, did you eat halal meat? Did you own a Quran? Do you have relatives in Turkey and Kazakhstan? And if you tick the right boxes, or rather if you tick the wrong boxes, you would be instantly categorized as a person of interest for the Chinese police and categorized by an algorithm that we know is not based in anything scientific. Because 8 years ago, really, there's no such thing as like data analysis to figure out who is a terrorist or not. Even now, there isn't such an algorithm. Mm. You just can't. You can't use data to show who's a terrorist or not, and that's what the Chinese government tried to do. And if you were a person of interest, you got thrown into these so-called re-education camps and had a lot of your rights stripped away from you. So that was really the genesis of the book. And what we really hoped to achieve with that book was to show both the positive side of Chinese surveillance and the negative side. And the takeaway really is just that surveillance is two sides of the same coin. Mm. You know, you have the one face, which is more positive externalities. You can catch criminals with AI-enabled, you know, cameras. But the negative side is you could use data and AI in the wrong way and have some innocent people like profiled in a way they didn't want to be.
I almost feel like that's quite prevalent in many societies now. A bit beyond China, no? These days. AI is everywhere, no?
it is. And, you know, 8 years ago, this was a fresh topic and it was pioneering. So
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I could go into the several ways that China had used data for population control, including over COVID when they used mobile phone signals to place where you were in a certain point. So they had what was equivalent to like a color coding system. If your mobile phone signal had overlapped with a COVID positive patient, then you'd get a knock on the door by health authorities and told to quarantine. So the data that they use goes beyond just like data on the form or your face, right? It is mobile phone signals. So they've really been quite pioneering, I guess, in using all these data for population control.
Super interesting. Maybe that's a second edition, no? Lisa? You have too much on your plate. Shifting gear a little bit, I want to kind of move into your story, get to know you as the person. It looks like your career has been like super set up, you know, very intentional. You're such a seasoned journalist. But have you had any pause? And I guess, what were the hardest ones?
Yeah, I would characterize my career as very unplanned, to be honest. And I would say my career has had a lot of detours. I've always known that I wanted to be a journalist, but it was the detours, the unexpected detours that threw out new opportunities that brought me to areas where I never expected I would be. When I graduated, I wanted to work for local media. There was a hiring freeze, so I went to join a foreign media outlet, and it's opened doors to allow me to be a foreign correspondent. So I would almost say that my career has been several lucky episodes of doors getting closed in my face, but another one opens. And it would be the open door, the new open door wouldn't have been something that I would have thought about. But I jumped at the chance anyway. And it led me to different things and aspects which I love. So if there's any, I think, one takeaway for your listeners on pauses, you know, pauses, depending on how you define a pause, like they might be a detour. I define it as a detour sometimes. Most pauses have a reason, and they often open up the chance to do new things that you would have never have considered before. So pauses are not necessarily a bad thing. That said, I would say there's one category of pause that I wish that nobody has to experience, and that's grief. So my hardest pause really came from my father getting diagnosed with leukemia and his subsequent passing. So that was the hardest pause I think I took. I took 13 months off from work and kind of spent more time with the family. And concurrently, I worked on Surveillance State, the book, at the same time. So it was a pause in my journalism career, but it really wasn't, you know, it wasn't a pause in the sense that I stopped working. I did take a couple of months off to process whatever happened. But I would say that was the hardest pause because it was A, unexpected, and it involved death.
Once again, so sorry to hear that. And one of my guests told me grief has no expiry date. Yeah. How are you doing, though?
When my father passed, it was genuinely very, very difficult. But I would say time does heal some wounds and some distance from the event. You know, if you had talked to me just a couple of years ago, I would be crying at this point. But some distance and some time from the event helps. And I have a very good friend. When my father passed, she came to me and she described death and losing a loved one as, you know, a ball that's bouncing in a very small box. When the event first happened, it is a huge ball bouncing in a small box. So every time that ball touches the side of the box, you are reminded of your loss, you are reminded of your grief, and it hurts. And because the ball is so big, it touches the sides of the box all the time, right? So you are constantly reminded, you know, reminders of where, like, your loved one ate, the type of hobbies that person did, you walk past places that you've, like, been to together. So every time you do that, it hurts. The ball is huge, As time goes by, the ball shrinks and it gets smaller. So it's not that the grief goes away. It is still there. But the grief rebounds on the side fewer times because the ball is just smaller. So I think that's how time heals. The ball gets smaller and it hits the sides fewer times. So you are constantly, you're reminded of it, but you're not reminded of it at the same frequency and intensity that it was before.
Thank you, Lisa, for sharing. I mean, I think the listeners will appreciate, I guess, that the analogy. It's a hard one. During that pause, you also do something else, right? You were writing your book. Like, how did you eventually kind of, I won't say move on, right? I mean, let go of that incident. And I guess step into the next chapter, you know. Sorry, Lisa.
No, it's okay. I think I let go when it really is like my mom at that point. We wanted to make sure my mom was doing okay. I think at the end of the day, people have to move on. I don't want to sound cold, but I think I let go of it. You know, after 13 months, I felt I was ready to go back to proper work and to, you know, to moving on. And I also knew that my father, you know, he was very proud of me for what I did, for the person I am. And you just want to keep doing that because you know that's what he wanted, right? My father wouldn't have wanted me to grieve nonstop. So that's kind of what drove me to move on.
Wow. I'm sure he's very proud of you. Wonderful lady you are already, and now mother of two. What's your definition of success now?
Yeah, if you had asked me what my definition of success was when I first started out my career, then it would be, you know, every journalist goes for a Pulitzer Prize. And I'll be like, oh, I want to, like, success would mean getting a Pulitzer. Now, I mean, I'm almost like 18, 19 years into the industry or out of school, basically. And I think success for me now is being able to balance the different hats that I have. You know, I see a lot of happiness coming from family, happiness that previously before family I would have derived from my career. So really, like, I think the notion of success kind of varies according to your life stage. So for me, success is being able to both be a good mom and also be good enough in my career that my kids, who are boys, would be proud of their mom. You know, I want them to grow up, to learn to respect the role of a mom.
A mom that does great things. So, Lisa, what do you fight for now?
That's a good question. I fight to make sure that my kids have a fair and balanced life. I fight to make sure the same stories that I talked about, you know, stories that were overlooked by policymakers and will prompt some positive policy action will be done. These are the two things that really drive me as a person. They've driven me the last, like, 19 years, and I don't really see that changing.
You just gave me goosebumps. You're so clear in what you fight for.
Actually, Linda, I think that really helps because when you know your end goal and you know what really drives you and motivates you as a person, it's a lot easier to handle pauses, either both unexpected or to take the pause as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm searching for that that clarity, by the way. And what anchors you? Your work mustn't be easy because you need to operate in uncertainty all the time and chaos. So what anchors you?
My family. I mean, it's hard to It's hard to think about anything else. My extended family, so being my mom and my sisters, and my own family, my two kids and my husband. I think my husband has been a completely inspirational figure in my life because he's actually able to help me out with the kids and also do his work. And I don't think I could have asked for any other person that could have been a better sounding block. If I'm always stuck on something, I know I talk to my husband and he always sounds right or he always sounds wise. Really, it's my family. Yeah.
Love that. And how do you recharge? I know it's a hard one.
Oh, I do like to go for, I do like to exercise. So I think it's quite critical that no matter how busy I am, I should try and squeeze in a workout. There are some weeks where it is difficult to do it more than once, but at the minimum once or twice. So, you know, my neighbors who, because my son's preschool is nearby and I will come back from school and I dump my bag and I just go for a few rounds around the field that's just next to my house. And my neighbors are like, you know, there are much nicer places and more scenic places to run in. And for me, it's about efficiency. I just want to run and then I go straight to the daycare. I pick my son and I bring him home. So I think that is that is how I recharge.
Your rounds are your respite.
Also, I listen to my lectures on Zoom when I run. So it's about multitasking. It's about being very efficient.
That's very Singaporean. I love that. And I guess looking ahead, how do you feel like your next decade would be?
I find it very difficult to forecast because I'm always about the next new opportunity in the sense that I'm very open to doing new things. And in fact, I like to do new things and experience new environments. So it's very hard to forecast my life. If you asked me 10 years ago what my next decade was, I couldn't tell you. And you asked me 20 years ago what my next decade was, I also couldn't tell you. So I don't want to try and gaze into the crystal ball now again.
All good. I hope you stay as a journalist so that we can get to write your story. And maybe even more, again, I think life is never stagnant, right? So, and after this fellowship, maybe there's something more that will come your way. And, this podcast is about people who are looking to pause or maybe in the middle of one. Who should I talk to? Any suggestion?
I would really like to hear from a male about a pause to support his wife's career. To me, that's super interesting because the roles are reversed. It's not stereotypical. It's usually the other way around. But I would like to hear, the thought process and what he's gotten from it, because there is a lot to be said about how fun it is to be hanging out with your kids, right? Mm-hmm. Much more fun than hanging out in a boardroom, I think. If you find such a character, I would be very interested to hear his story.
Mm. Sounds like a missionary. You're not the first one. Thank you, Lisa. Anything else to add? I guess for people who are listening in, someone who may not be your typical person who takes an intentional pause, I guess any advice for people?
Yeah, I would say that intentional pauses are good. I don't usually take intentional pauses, but, I have taken a pause to come to MIT. I did take a pause to do my master's. And the pauses allow you to really kind of see at a much higher level and think at a much more fundamental level about who you are, And allows you to explore new things that when you were stuck in your job, you wouldn't be exposed to. You know, I love technology and I thought I would be writing about technology for all my life. But coming to MIT, I'm learning about nuclear science. I'm learning about biology, climate change. You're being exposed to different things that if you didn't take the pause, you would not have been exposed to. And I love this as well. I find it as fascinating as technology. So I think intentional pauses are good. It doesn't always seem that way. But the other thing I've also learned is like our brain allows us to adapt very quickly to new environments, even if it's an unexpected pause. Grief is obviously, I think, a separate issue, but you know, if it's an unexpected pause like a layoff, you'd be surprised how the brain adapts, and you don't really feel the hit of that layoff as badly in, let's say, 2 weeks or even a month after it happens. It's proven science. I'm not just dishing this out. It's, you know, that's how our brain works. It helps us to cope.
Thank you, Lisa. It has been fascinating to talk to you, and thank you for being so vulnerable. I would just want to ask all the people who are listening in to follow us so that we can stay tuned to more stories like this. Thank you, Lisa.